Morning drew on apace. The air became more sharp and piercing, as its first dull hue, the death of night rather than the birth of day, glimmered faintly in the sky. The objects which had looked dim and terrible in the darkness grew more and more defined, and gradually resolved into their familiar shapes. The rain came down thick and fast, and pattered noisily among the leafless bushes. But Oliver felt it not, as it beat against him, for he still lay stretched, helpless, and unconscious, on his bed of clay. At length, a low cry of pain broke the stillness that prevailed, and uttering it, the boy awoke. His left arm, rudely bandaged in a shawl, hung heavy and useless at his side. The bandage was saturated with blood. He was so weak that he could scarcely raise himself into a sitting posture. When he had done so, he looked feebly round for help and groaned with pain. Trembling in every joint from cold and exhaustion, he made an effort to stand upright, but shuddering from head to foot, fell prostrate on the ground. After a short return of the stupor in which he had been so long plunged, Oliver, urged by a creeping sickness at his heart, which seemed to warn him that if he lay there he must surely die, got upon his feet and essayed to walk. His head was dizzy, and he staggered to and fro like a drunken man. But he kept up, nevertheless, and, with his head drooping languidly on his breast, went stumbling onward he knew not whither. And now hosts of bewildering and confused ideas came crowding on his mind. He seemed to be still walking between Sykes and Crackit, who were angrily disputing, for the very words they said sounded in his ears. And when he caught his own attention, as it were, by making some violent effort to save himself from falling, he found that he was talking to them. Then he was alone with Sykes, plodding on as on the previous day, and as shadowy people passed them, he felt the robber's grasp upon his wrist. Suddenly he started back at the report of firearms. There rose into the air loud cries and shouts. Lights gleamed before his eyes. All was noise and tumult. Some unseen hand bore him hurriedly away. Through all these rapid visions there ran an undefined, uneasy consciousness of pain, which wearied and tormented him incessantly. Thus he staggered on, creeping almost mechanically between the bars of gates or through hedge gaps as they came in his way, until he reached a road. Here the rain began to fall so heavily that it roused him. He looked about and saw that at no great distance there was a house, which perhaps he could reach. Pitying his condition, they might have compassion on him. And if they did not, it would be better, he thought, to die near human beings than in the lonely open fields. He summoned up all his strength for one last trial and bent his faltering steps towards it. As he drew nearer to this house, a feeling came over him that he had seen it before. He remembered nothing of its details, but the shape and aspect of the building seemed familiar to him. That garden wall! On the grass inside, he had fallen on his knees last night and prayed the two men's mercy. It was the very house they had attempted to rob. Oliver felt such fear come over him when he recognized the place that for the instant he forgot the agony of his wound and thought only of flight. Flight! He could scarcely stand. And if he were in full possession of all the best powers of his slight and youthful frame, whither could he fly? He pushed against the garden gate. It was unlocked and swung open on its hinges. He tottered across the lawn, climbed the steps, knocked faintly at the door, and his whole strength failing him, sunk down against one of the pillars of the little portico. It happened that about this time Mr. Giles, Brittles, and the tinker were recruiting themselves after the fatigues and terrors of the night with tea and sundries in the kitchen. Not that it was Mr. Giles's habit to admit to too great familiarity the humbler servants, towards whom it was rather his wont to deport himself with a lofty affability which, while it gratified, could not fail to remind them of his superior position in society. but death, fires, and burglary make all men equals. So Mr. Giles sat with his legs stretched out before the kitchen fender, leaning his left arm on the table, while, with his right, he illustrated a circumstantial and minute account of the robbery, to which his hearers, but especially the cook and housemaid, who were of the party, listened with breathless interest. "It was about 2:30, said Mr. Giles, "though I wouldn't swear that it mightn't have been a little nearer 3, when I woke up and, turning round in my bed, as it might be so"—here Mr. Giles turned round in his chair and pulled the corner of the tablecloth over him to imitate bedclothes—"I fancied I heard a noise." At this point of the narrative, the cook turned pale, and asked the housemaid to shut the door, who asked Brittles, who asked the tinker, who pretended not to hear. "Heard a noise," continued Mr. Giles. "I says, at first, 'This is illusion,' and was composing myself off to sleep, when I heard the noise again, distinct."
"What sort of a noise?" asked the cook.
"A kind of a busting noise," replied Mr. Giles, looking round him.
"More like the noise of powdering a iron bar on a nutmeg grater," suggested Brittles.
"It was when you heard it, sir," rejoined Mr. Giles, "but at this time it had a busting sound." "I turned down the clothes," continued Giles, rolling back the tablecloth, "sat up in bed, and listened."
The cook and housemaid simultaneously ejaculated, "Law!" and drew their chairs closer together.
"I heard it now, quite apparent," resumed Mr. Giles. "Somebody, I says, is forcing of a door or window. What's to be done? I'll call up that poor lad Brittles, and save him from being murdered in his bed. Or his throat, I says, may be cut from his right ear to his left, without his ever knowing it."
Here all eyes were turned upon Brittles, who fixed his upon the speaker and stared at him with his mouth wide open and his face expressive of the most unmitigated horror.
"I tossed off the clothes," said Giles, throwing away the tablecloth and looking very hard at the cook and housemaid, "got softly out of bed, drew on a pair of—"
"Ladies present, Mr. Giles," murmured the tinker.
"Of shoes, sir," said Giles, turning upon him and laying great emphasis on the word, "seized the loaded pistol that always goes upstairs with the plate basket, and walked on tiptoes to his room. 'Brittles,' I says, when I had woke him, 'don't be frightened.'"
"So you did," observed Brittles in a low voice.
"We're dead men, I think, Brittles," I says, continued Giles, "but don't be frightened."
"Was he frightened?" asked the cook.
"Not a bit of it," replied Mr. Giles. "He was as firm, pretty near as firm as I was."
"I should have died at once, I'm sure, if it had been me," observed the housemaid.
"You're a woman," retorted Brittles, plucking up a little.
"Brittles is right," said Mr. Giles, nodding his head approvingly. "From a woman, nothing else was to be expected. We, being men, took a dark lantern that was standing on Brittles' hob and groped our way downstairs in the pitch dark, as it might be so."
Mr. Giles had risen from his seat and taken 2 steps with his eyes shut to accompany his description with appropriate action, when he started violently, in common with the rest of the company, and hurried back to his chair. The cook and housemaid screamed.
"It was a knock,"
said Mr. Giles, assuming perfect serenity.
"Open the door, somebody."
Nobody moved.
"It seems a strange sort of a thing, a knock coming at such a time in the morning," said Mr. Giles, surveying the pale faces which surrounded him, and looking very blank himself. "But the door must be opened. Do you hear, somebody?"
Mr. Giles, as he spoke, looked at Brittles, but that young man, being naturally modest, probably considered himself nobody, and so held that the inquiry could not have any application to him. At all events, he tendered no reply. Mr. Giles directed an appealing glance at the tinker, but he had suddenly fallen asleep. The women were out of the question.
"If Brittles would rather open the door in the presence of witnesses," said Mr. Giles, after a short silence, "I am ready to make one."
"So am I," said the tinker, waking up as suddenly as he had fallen asleep. Brittles capitulated on these terms, and the party being somewhat reassured by the discovery made on throwing open the shutters that it was now broad day, took their way upstairs, with the dogs in front. The two women, who were afraid to stay below, brought up the rear. By the advice of Mr. Giles, they all talked very loud to warn any evil-disposed person outside that they were strong in numbers, and by a masterstroke of policy originating in the brain of the same ingenious gentleman, the dogs' tails were well pinched in the hall to make them bark savagely. These precautions having been taken, Mr. Giles held on fast by the tinker's arm to prevent his running away, as he pleasantly said, and gave the word of command to open the door. Brittles obeyed. The group, peeping timorously over each other's shoulders, beheld no more formidable object than poor little Oliver Twist, speechless and exhausted, who raised his heavy eyes and mutely solicited their compassion. "A boy!" exclaimed Mr. Giles, valiantly pushing the tinker into the background. "What's the matter with the... Why, Brittles, look here, don't you know?" Brittles, who had got behind the door to open it, no sooner saw Oliver than he uttered a loud cry. Mr. Giles, seizing the boy by one leg and one arm, fortunately not the broken limb, lugged him straight into the hall and deposited him at full length on the floor thereof. "Here he is," bawled Giles, calling in a state of great excitement up the staircase. "Here's one of the thieves, ma'am. Here's a thief, miss. Wounded, miss. I shot him, miss." And Brittles held the light. "In a lantern, miss," cried Brittles, applying one hand to the side of his mouth so that his voice might travel the better. The two women servants ran upstairs to carry the intelligence that Mr. Giles had captured a robber, and the tinker busied himself in endeavouring to restore Oliver, lest he should die before he could be hanged. In the midst of all this noise and commotion, there was heard a sweet female voice which quelled it in an instant. "Giles," whispered the voice from the stairhead.
"I'm here, miss," replied Mr. Giles. "Don't be frightened, miss. I ain't much injured. He didn't make a very desperate resistance, miss. I was soon too many for him."
"Hush," replied the young lady. "You frighten my aunt as much as the thieves did. Is the poor creature much hurt?"
"Wounded, desperate, miss," replied Giles with indescribable complacency. "He looks as if he was a-going, miss," bawled Brittles, in the same manner as before. "Wouldn't you like to come and look at him, miss, in case he should?"
"Hush, pray, there's a good man," rejoined the lady. "Wait quietly only one instant while I speak to my aunt." With a footstep as soft and gentle as the voice, the speaker tripped away. She soon returned with the direction that the wounded person was to be carried carefully upstairs to Mr. Giles's room, and that Brittles was to saddle the pony and betake himself instantly to Chertsey, from which place he was to dispatch with all speed a constable and doctor.
"But won't you take one look at him first, miss?"
asked Mr. Giles, with as much pride as if Oliver were some bird of rare plumage that he had skilfully brought down.
"Not one little peep, miss?"
"Not now for the world," replied the young lady. "Poor fellow, oh, treat him kindly, Giles, for my sake." The old servant looked up at the speaker as she turned away, with a glance as proud and admiring as if she had been his own child. Then, bending over Oliver, he helped to carry him upstairs with the care and solicitude of a woman. Chapter 29 has an introductory account of the inmates of the house to which Oliver resorted. In a handsome room, though its furniture had rather the air of old-fashioned comfort than of modern elegance, there sat two ladies at a well-spread breakfast table. Mr. Giles, dressed with scrupulous care, in a full suit of black, was in attendance upon them. He had taken his station some halfway between the sideboard and the breakfast table, and, with his body drawn up to its full height, his head thrown back and inclined the merest trifle on one side, his left leg advanced, and his right hand thrust into his waistcoat, while his left hung down by his side, grasping a waiter, looked like one who laboured under a very agreeable sense of his own merits and importance.
Of the two ladies, one was well advanced in years, but the high-backed oaken chair in which she sat was not more upright than she. Dressed with the utmost nicety and precision, in a quaint mixture of bygone costume, with some slight concessions to the prevailing taste, which rather served to point the old style pleasantly than to impair its effect, she sat in a stately manner, with her hands folded on the table before her. Her eyes, and age had dimmed but little of their brightness, were attentively fixed upon her young companion. The younger lady was in the lovely bloom and springtime of womanhood. At that age when, if ever angels be for God's good purposes enthroned in mortal forms, they may be without impiety supposed to abide in such as hers. She was not past 17. Cast in so slight and exquisite a mould, so mild and gentle, so pure and beautiful, that earth seemed not her element, nor its rough creatures her fit companions. The very intelligence that shone in her deep blue eyes and was stamped upon her noble head seemed scarcely of her age, or of the world. And yet the changing expression of sweetness and good humour, the thousand lights that played about the face and left no shadow there, above all the smile, the cheerful, happy smile, were made for home and fireside peace and happiness. She was busily engaged in the little offices of the table. Chancing to raise her eyes as the elder lady was regarding her, she playfully put back her hair, which was simply braided on her forehead, and threw into her beaming look such an expression of affection and artless loveliness that blessed spirits might have smiled to look upon her. "And Brittles has been gone upwards of an hour, has he?" asked the old lady, after a pause.
"An hour and 12 minutes, ma'am," replied Mr. Giles, referring to a silver watch which he drew forth by a black ribbon.
"He is always slow," remarked the old lady.
"Brittles was always a slow boy, ma'am," replied the attendant.
And seeing, by the by, that Brittles had been a slow boy for upwards of 30 years, there appeared no great probability of his ever being a fast one.
"He gets worse instead of better, I think," said the elder lady.
"It is very inexcusable in him if he stops to play with any other boys," said the young lady, smiling. Mr. Giles was apparently considering the propriety of indulging in a respectful smile himself, when a gig drove up to the garden gate, out of which there jumped a fat gentleman who ran straight up to the door, and who, getting quickly into the house by some mysterious process, burst into the room and nearly overturned Mr. Giles and the breakfast table together.
"I never heard of such a thing," exclaimed the fat gentleman. "My dear Mrs. Maley, bless my soul, in the silence of night too, I never heard of such a thing."
With these expressions of condolence, the fat gentleman shook hands with both ladies, and, drawing up a chair, inquired how they found themselves.
"You ought to be dead, positively dead with the fright," said the fat gentleman. "Why didn't you send? Bless me, my man should have come in a minute, and so would I, and my assistant would have been delighted, or anybody, I'm sure, under such circumstances. Dear, dear, so unexpected, in the silence of night, too."
The doctor seemed especially troubled by the fact of the robbery having been unexpected and attempted in the night time, as if it were the established custom of gentlemen in the housebreaking way to transact business at noon and to make an appointment by post a day or two previous.
"And you, Miss Rose," said the doctor, turning to the young lady.
"Oh, very much so indeed," said Rose, interrupting him. "But there is a poor creature upstairs whom Aunt wishes you to see."
"Ah, to be sure," replied the doctor. "So there is. That was your handiwork, Giles, I understand."
Mr. Giles, who had been feverishly putting the teacups to rights, blushed very red, and said that he had had that honour.
"Honour, eh?" said the doctor. "Well, I don't know. Perhaps it's as honourable to hit a thief in a back kitchen as to hit your man at 12 paces. Fancy that he fired in the air, and you fought a duel, Giles."
Mr. Giles, who thought this light treatment of the matter an unjust attempt at diminishing his glory, answered respectfully that it was not for the like of him to judge about that, but he rather thought it was no joke to the opposite party.
"Gad, that's true," said the doctor. "Where is he? Show me the way. I'll look in again as I come down, Mrs. Maley. That's the little window that he got in at, eh? Well, I couldn't have believed it."
Talking all the way, he followed Mr. Giles upstairs. And while he is going upstairs, the reader may be informed that Mr. Losburn, a surgeon in the neighbourhood, known through a circuit of 10 miles round as the doctor, had grown fat more from good humour than from good living, and was as kind and hearty, and withal as eccentric an old bachelor, as will be found in 5 times that space by any explorer alive. The doctor was absent much longer than either he or the ladies had anticipated. A large flat box was fetched out of the gig, and a bedroom bell was rung very often, and the servants ran up and downstairs perpetually, from which tokens it was justly concluded that something important was going on above. At length he returned, and in reply to an anxious inquiry after his patient, looked very mysterious, and closed the door carefully.
"This is a very extraordinary thing, Mrs. Maley," said the doctor, standing with his back to the door as if to keep it shut.
"He is not in danger, I hope," said the old lady.
"Why, that would not be an extraordinary thing under the circumstances," replied the doctor, "though I don't think he is. Have you seen this thief?"
"No," rejoined the old lady.
"Nor heard anything about him?"
"No."
"I beg your pardon, ma'am," interposed Mr. Giles, "but I was going to tell you about him when Dr. Losburn came in."
The fact was that Mr. Giles had not at first been able to bring his mind to the avowal that he had only shot a boy. Such commendations had been bestowed upon his bravery that he could not for the life of him help postponing the explanation for a few delicious minutes, during which he had flourished in the very zenith of a brief reputation for undaunted courage. "Rose wished to see the man," said Mrs. Maley, "but I wouldn't hear of it."
"Ah-ha," rejoined the doctor. "There is nothing very alarming in his appearance. Have you any objection to see him in my presence?"
"If it be necessary," replied the old lady, "certainly not."
"Then I think it is necessary," said the doctor. "At all events, I am quite sure that you would deeply regret not having done so if you postponed it."
"He is perfectly quiet and comfortable now. Allow me. Miss Rose, will you permit me?"
"Not the slightest fear. I pledge you my honour."
End of side 7. Side 8. Chapter 30 relates what Oliver's new visitors thought of him. With many loquacious assurances that they would be agreeably surprised in the aspect of the criminal, the doctor drew the young lady's arm through one of his, and offering his disengaged hand to Mrs. Maley, led them with much ceremony and stateliness upstairs. "Now," said the doctor in a whisper as he softly turned the handle of a bedroom door, "let us hear what you think of him. He has not been shaved very recently, but he doesn't look at all ferocious notwithstanding. Stop, though. Let me first see that he is in visiting order." Stepping before them, he looked into the room. Motioning them to advance, he closed the door when they had entered and gently drew back the curtains of the bed. Upon it, in lieu of the dogged, black-visaged ruffian they had expected to behold, there lay a mere child, worn with pain and exhaustion, and sunk into a deep sleep. His wounded arm, bound and splintered up, was crossed upon his breast. His head reclined upon the other arm, which was half hidden by his long hair, as it streamed over the pillow. The honest gentleman held the curtain in his hand, and looked on for a minute or so in silence. While he was watching the patient thus, the younger lady glided softly past, and seating herself in a chair by the bedside, gathered Oliver's hair from his face. As she stooped over him, her tears fell upon his forehead. The boy stirred and smiled in his sleep, as though these marks of pity and compassion had awakened some pleasant dream of a love and affection he had never known. Thus, a strain of gentle music, or the rippling of water in a silent place, or the odour of a flower, or the mention of a familiar word, will sometimes call up sudden dim remembrances of scenes that never were in this life, which vanish like a breath, which some brief memory of a happier existence long gone by would seem to have awakened, which no voluntary exertion of the mind can ever recall.
"What can this mean?" exclaimed the elder lady. "This poor child can never have been the pupil of robbers."
"Vice," sighed the surgeon, replacing the curtain, "takes up her abode in many temples. And who can say that a fair outside shall not enshrine her?"
"But at so early an age," urged Rose.
"My dear young lady," rejoined the surgeon, mournfully shaking his head, "crime, like death, is not confined to the old and withered alone. The youngest and fairest are too often its chosen victims."
"But can you really believe that this delicate boy has been the voluntary associate of the worst outcasts of society?" said Rose anxiously. The surgeon shook his head in a manner which intimated that he feared it was very possible, and, observing that they might disturb the patient, led the way into an adjoining apartment. "But even if he has been wicked," pursued Rose, "think how young he is. Think that he may never have known a mother's love or the comfort of a home, that ill usage and blows or the want of bread may have driven him to herd with men who have forced him to guilt. Aunt, dear aunt, for mercy's sake, think of this before you let them drag this sick child to a prison, which in any case must be the grave of all his chances of amendment. Oh, as you love me, and know that I have never felt the want of parents in your goodness and affection, but that I might have done so, and might have been equally helpless and unprotected with this poor child, have pity upon him before it is too late."
"My dear love," said the elder lady, as she folded the weeping girl to her bosom,
"do you think I would harm a hair of his head?"
"Oh, no," replied Rose eagerly. "No, surely," said the old lady. "My days are drawing to their close, and may mercy be shown to me as I show it to others. What can I do to save him, sir?"
"Let me think, ma'am," said the doctor. "Let me think."
Mr. Losburn thrust his hands into his pockets and took several turns up and down the room, often stopping and balancing himself on his toes and frowning frightfully. After various exclamations of, "I've got it now," and, "No, I haven't," and as many renewals of the walking and frowning, he at length made a dead halt and spoke as follows.
"I think if you give me a full and unlimited commission to bully Giles and that little boy, Brittles, I can manage it. Giles is a faithful fellow and an old servant, I know, but you can make it up to him in a thousand ways and reward him for being such a good shot besides. You don't object to that?"
"Unless there is some other way of preserving the child," replied Mrs. Maylie.
"There is no other," said the doctor. "No other, take my word for it."
"Then my aunt invests you with full power," said Rose, smiling through her tears. "But pray don't be harder upon the poor fellows than is indispensably necessary."
"You seem to think," retorted the doctor, "that everybody is disposed to be hard-hearted today, except yourself, Miss Rose. I only hope, for the sake of the rising male sex generally, that you may be found in as vulnerable and soft-hearted mood by the first eligible young fellow who appeals to your compassion, and I wish I were a young fellow that I might avail myself on the spot of such a favourable opportunity for doing so as the present."
"You are as great a boy as poor Brittles himself," returned Rose, blushing.
"Well," said the doctor, laughing heartily, "that is no very difficult matter.
But to return to this boy, the great point of our agreement is yet to come. He will wake in an hour or so, I dare say, and although I have told that thick-headed constable fellow downstairs that he mustn't be moved or spoken to on peril of his life, I think we may converse with him without danger. Now, I make this stipulation that I shall examine him in your presence, and that if, from what he says, we judge, and I can show to the satisfaction of your cool reason that he is a real and thorough bad one, which is more than possible, he shall be left to his fate, without any farther interference on my part, at all events."
"Oh, no, aunt," entreated Rose.
"Oh, yes, aunt," said the doctor. "Is it a bargain?"
"He cannot be hardened in vice," said Rose. "It is impossible."
"Very good," retorted the doctor. "Then so much the more reason for acceding to my proposition."
Finally, the treaty was entered into, and the parties thereunto sat down to wait with some impatience until Oliver should awake. The patience of the two ladies was destined to undergo a longer trial than Mr. Losburn had led them to expect. for hour after hour passed on, and still Oliver slumbered heavily. It was evening, indeed, before the kind-hearted doctor brought them the intelligence that he was, at length, sufficiently restored to be spoken to. The boy was very ill, he said, and weak from the loss of blood. But his mind was so troubled with anxiety to disclose something that he deemed it better to give him the opportunity than to insist upon his remaining quiet until next morning, which he should otherwise have done. The conference was a long one. Oliver told them all his simple history, and was often compelled to stop by pain and want of strength. It was a solemn thing to hear, in the darkened room, the feeble voice of the sick child recounting a weary catalogue of evils and calamities which hard men had brought upon him. Oh, if when we oppress and grind our fellow creatures, we bestowed but one thought on the dark evidences of human error, which, like dense and heavy clouds, are rising, slowly it is true, but not less surely, to heaven, to pour their after-vengeance on our heads. If we heard but one instant, in imagination, the deep testimony of dead men's voices, which no power can stifle, and no pride shut out, where would be the injury and injustice, the suffering, misery, cruelty, and wrong that each day's life brings with it? Oliver's pillow was smoothed by gentle hands that night, and loveliness and virtue watched him as he slept. He felt calm and happy, and could have died without a murmur. The momentous interview was no sooner concluded, and Oliver composed to rest again, than the doctor, after wiping his eyes, and condemning them for being weak all at once, betook himself downstairs to open upon Mr. Giles. And finding nobody about the parlours, it occurred to him that he could perhaps originate the proceedings with better effect in the kitchen. So into the kitchen he went. There were assembled, in that lower house of the domestic parliament, the women servants, Mr. Brittles, Mr. Giles, the tinker, who had received a special invitation to regale himself for the remainder of the day, in consideration of his services, and the constable. The latter gentleman had a large staff, a large head, large features, and large half-boots, and he looked as if he had been taking a proportionate allowance of ale, as indeed he had. The adventures of the previous night were still under discussion, for Mr. Giles was expatiating upon his presence of mind when the doctor entered. Mr. Brittles, with a mug of ale in his hand, was corroborating everything before his superior said it.
"Sit still," said the doctor, waving his hand.
"Thank you, sir," said Mr. Giles. "Missus wished some ale to be given out, sir, and as I felt no ways inclined for my own little room, sir, and was disposed for company, I am taking mine among 'em here."
Brittles headed a low murmur, by which the ladies and gentlemen generally were understood to express the gratification they derived from Mr. Giles's condescension. Mr. Giles looked round with a patronising air, as much as to say that so long as they behaved properly, he would never desert them.
"How is the patient tonight, sir?" asked Giles.
"So-so," returned the doctor. "I am afraid you have got yourself into a scrape there, Mr. Giles."
"I hope you don't mean to say, sir," said Mr. Giles, trembling, "that he's going to die. If I thought it, I should never be happy again. I wouldn't cut a boy off, no, not even Brittles here, not for all the plate in the county, sir."
"That's not the point," said the doctor, mysteriously.
"Mr. Giles, are you a Protestant?"
Yes, sir, I hope so," faltered Mr. Giles, who had turned very pale.
"And what are you, boy?"
said the doctor, turning sharply upon Brittles.
"Lord bless me, sir," replied Brittles, starting violently. "I'm the same as Mr. Giles, sir."
"Then tell me this," said the doctor. Both of you, are you going to take upon yourselves to swear that that boy upstairs is the boy that was put through the little window last night? Out with it, come, we are prepared for you."
The doctor,
who was universally considered one of the best-tempered creatures on earth, made this demand in such a dreadful tone of anger that Giles and Brittles, who were considerably muddled by ale and excitement, stared at each other in a state of stupefaction.
"Pay attention to the reply, constable, will you?"
said the doctor, shaking his forefinger with great solemnity of manner and tapping the bridge of his nose with it to bespeak the exercise of that worthy's utmost acuteness.
"Something may come of this before long."
The constable looked as wise as he could, and took up his staff of office, which had been reclining indolently in the chimney corner.
"It's a simple question of identity, you'll observe," said the doctor. "That's what it is, sir,"
replied the constable, coughing with great violence, for he had finished his ale in a hurry, and some of it had gone the wrong way.
"Here's a house broken into," said the doctor, "and a couple of men catch one moment's glimpse of a boy in the midst of gunpowder smoke and in all the distraction of alarm and darkness. Here's a boy comes to that very same house next morning, and because he happens to have his arm tied up, these men lay violent hands upon him, by doing which they place his life in great danger and swear he is the thief. Now, the question is whether these men are justified by the fact. If not, in what situation do they place themselves?"
The constable nodded profoundly. He said, if that wasn't law, he would be glad to know what was.
"I ask you again," thundered the doctor, "are you, on your solemn oaths, able to identify that boy?"
Brittles looked doubtfully at Mr. Giles. Mr. Giles looked doubtfully at Brittles. The constable put his hand behind his ear to catch the reply. The two women and the tinker leaned forward to listen. The doctor glanced keenly round, when a ring was heard at the gate, and at the same moment the sound of wheels. "It's the runners!" cried Brittles, to all appearance much relieved.
"The what?"
exclaimed the doctor, aghast in his turn. "The Bow Street officers, sir," replied Brittles, taking up a candle. "Me and Mr. Giles sent for 'em this morning."
"What?" cried the doctor.
"Yes," replied Brittles. "I sent a message up by the coachman, and I only wonder they weren't here before, sir."
"You did you? Then confound and damn your...
slow coaches down here. That's all," said the doctor, walking away.
Chapter 31 Involves a Critical Position.
"Who's that?"
inquired Brittles, opening the door a little way with the chain up and peeping out, shading the candle with his hand.
"Open the door,"
replied a man outside.
"It's the officers from Bow Street as was sent to today."
Much comforted by this assurance, Brittles opened the door to its full width and confronted a portly man in a greatcoat, who walked in without saying anything more and wiped his shoes on the mat as coolly as if he lived there.
"Just send somebody out to relieve my mate, will you, young man?"
said the officer.
"He's in the gig, a-minding the prad. Have you got a coach us here that you could put it up in for 5 or 10 minutes?"
Brittles replying in the affirmative and pointing out the building, the portly man stepped back to the garden gate and helped his companion to put up the gig, while Brittles lighted them in a state of great admiration. This done, they returned to the house, and being shown into a parlour, took off their greatcoats and hats, and showed like what they were. The man who had knocked at the door was a stout personage of middle height, aged about 50, with shiny black hair cropped pretty close, half whiskers, a round face, and sharp eyes. The other was a red-headed, bony man in top boots, with a rather ill-favoured countenance and a turned-up, sinister-looking nose.
"Tell your governor that Blathers and Duff is here, will you?"
said the stouter man, smoothing down his hair and laying a pair of handcuffs on the table.
"Oh, good evening, master. Can I have a word or two with you in private, if you please?"
This was addressed to Mr. Losburn, who now made his appearance. That gentleman, motioning Brittles to retire, brought in the two ladies and shut the door.
"This is the lady of the house," said Mr. Losburn, motioning towards Mrs. Maley.
Mr. Blathers made a bow. Being desired to sit down, he put his hat on the floor and, taking a chair, motioned Duff to do the same. The latter gentleman, who did not appear quite so much accustomed to good society, or quite so much at his ease in it, one of the two, seated himself after undergoing several muscular affections of the limbs and forced the head of his stick into his mouth with some embarrassment.
"Now, with regard to this here robbery, master," said Blathers, "what are the circumstances?"
Mr. Losburn, who appeared desirous of gaining time, recounted them at great length and with much circumlocution. Messrs. Blathers and Duff looked very knowing meanwhile, and occasionally exchanged a nod.
"I can't say for certain till I see the work, of course," said Blathers. "But my opinion at once is, I don't mind committing myself to that extent, that this wasn't done by a yokel. Eh, Duff?"
"Certainly not," replied Duff. "And translating the word yokel for the benefit of the ladies, I apprehend your meaning to be that this attempt was not made by a countryman," said Mr. Losburn, with a smile.
"That's it, master," replied Blathers. "This is all about the robbery, is it?"
"All," replied the doctor.
"Now, what is this about this here boy that the servants are a-talking on?"
said Blathers.
"Nothing at all," replied the doctor. "One of the frightened servants chose to take it into his head that he had something to do with this attempt to break into the house, but it's nonsense, sheer absurdity."
"Very easy disposed of, if it is," remarked Duff. "What he says is quite correct," observed Blathers, nodding his head in a confirmatory way and playing carelessly with the handcuffs as if they were a pair of castanets. "Who is the boy? What account does he give of himself? Where did he come from? He didn't drop out of the clouds, did he, master?"
"Of course not," replied the doctor, with a nervous glance at the two ladies. "I know his whole history, but we can talk about that presently. You would like first to see the place where the thieves made their attempt, I suppose?"
"Certainly," rejoined Mr. Blathers. "We had better inspect the premises first and examine the servants afterwards. That's the usual way of doing business."
Lights were then procured, and Messrs. Blathers and Duff, attended by the native constable, Brittles, Giles, and everybody else, in short, went into the little room at the end of the passage and looked out at the window, and afterwards went round by way of the lawn and looked in at the window, and after that had a candle handed out to inspect the shutter with, and after that a lantern to trace the footsteps with, and after that a pitchfork to poke the bushes with. This done, amidst the breathless interest of all beholders, they came in again, and Mr. Giles and Brittles were put through a melodramatic representation of their share in the previous night's adventures, which they performed some six times over, contradicting each other in not more than one important respect the first time, and in not more than a dozen the last. This consummation being arrived at, Blathers and Duff cleared the room and held a long council together, compared with which, for secrecy and solemnity, a consultation of great doctors on the knottiest point in medicine would be mere child's play. Meanwhile, the doctor walked up and down the next room in a very uneasy state, and Mrs. Maley and Rose looked on with anxious faces. "Upon my word," he said, making a halt after a great number of very rapid turns, "I hardly know what to do." "Surely," said Rose, "the poor child's story, faithfully repeated to these men, will be sufficient to exonerate him."
"I doubt it, my dear young lady," said the doctor, shaking his head. "I don't think it would exonerate him, either with them or with legal functionaries of a higher grade. What is he, after all, they would say, a runaway? Judged by mere worldly considerations and probabilities, his story is a very doubtful one."
"You believe it, surely?" interrupted Rose.
"I believe it, strange as it is, and perhaps I may be an old fool for doing so," rejoined the doctor. "But I don't think it is exactly the tale for a practised police officer, nevertheless."
"Why not?" demanded Rose.
"Because, my pretty cross-examiner," replied the doctor, "because, viewed with their eyes, there are many ugly points about it. He can only prove the parts that look ill, and none of those that look well. Confound the fellows, they will have the why and the wherefore, and will take nothing for granted.
On his own showing, you see, he has been the companion of thieves for some time past. He has been carried to a police office on a charge of picking a gentleman's pocket. He has been taken away forcibly from that gentleman's house to a place which he cannot describe or point out, and of the situation of which he has not the remotest idea. He is brought down to Chertsey by men who seem to have taken a violent fancy to him, whether he will or no. and is put through a window to rob a house. And then, just at the very moment when he is going to alarm the inmates, and so do the very thing that would set him all to rights, there rushes into the way a blundering dog of a half-bred butler and shoots him, as if on purpose to prevent his doing any good for himself. Don't you see all this?
I see it, of course, replied Rose, smiling at the doctor's impetuosity. But still I do not see anything in it to criminate the poor child.
No, replied the doctor, of course not. Bless the bright eyes of your sex. They never see, whether for good or bad, more than one side of any question, and that is always the one which first presents itself to them.
Having given vent to this result of experience, the doctor put his hands into his pockets and walked up and down the room with even greater rapidity than before.
The more I think of it, said the doctor, the more I see that it will occasion endless trouble and difficulty if we put these men in possession of the boy's real story. I am certain it will not be believed, and even if they can do nothing to him in the end, still the dragging it forward and giving publicity to all the doubts that will be cast upon it must interfere materially with your benevolent plan of rescuing him from misery.
Oh, what is to be done? Cried Rose. Dear, dear, why did they send for these people?
Why, indeed, exclaimed Mrs. Maylie. I would not have had them here for the world.
All I know is, said Mr. Losburn at last, sitting down with a kind of desperate calmness, that we must try and carry it off with a bold face. The object is a good one, and that must be our excuse. The boy has strong symptoms of fever upon him and is in no condition to be talked to any more. That's one comfort. We must make the best of it we can, and if bad is the best, it is no fault of ours. Come in.
Well, master,
said Blathers, entering the room, followed by his colleague, and making the door fast before he said any more.
This want a put-up thing.
And what the devil's a put-up thing? Demanded the doctor impatiently.
We call it a put-up robbery, ladies, said Blathers, turning to them as if he pitied their ignorance but had a contempt for the doctor's, when the servants is in it.
Nobody suspected them in this case, said Mrs. Maylie.
Very likely not, ma'am, replied Blathers, but they might have been in it for all that.
More likely on that wery account, said Duff.
We find it was a town hand, said Blathers, continuing his report, for the style of work is first rate.
Very pretty indeed it is, remarked Duff in an undertone.
There was two of them in it, continued Blathers, and they had a boy with them. That's plain from the size of the window. That's all to be said at present. We'll see this lad that you've got upstairs at once, if you please.
Perhaps they will take something to drink first, Mrs. Maylie, said the doctor, his face brightening, as if some new thought had occurred to him. Oh,
to be sure, exclaimed Rose, eagerly. You shall have it immediately, if you will.
Why, thank you, miss, said Blathers, drawing his coat sleeve across his mouth. It's dry work, this sort of duty. Anything that's handy, miss, don't put yourself out of the way on our accounts.
What shall it be? Asked the doctor, following the young lady to the sideboard.
A little drop of spirits, master, if it's all the same, replied Blathers. It's a cold ride from London, ma'am, and I always find that spirits comes home warmer to the feelings.
This interesting communication was addressed to Mrs. Maylie, who received it very graciously. While it was being conveyed to her, the doctor slipped out of the room.
Ah,
said Mr. Blathers, not holding the wineglass by the stem, but grasping the bottom between the thumb and forefinger of his left hand and placing it in front of his chest.
I have seen a good many pieces of business like this in my time, ladies.
That crack down in the back lane at Edmonton, Blathers,
said Mr. Duff, assisting his colleague's memory.
Yeah, that was something in this way, wasn't it?
Rejoined Mr. Blathers.
That was done by Conky Chickweed, that was.
You always gave that to him, replied Duff. It was the family pet, I tell you. Conky hadn't any more to do with it than I had.
Get out, retorted Mr. Blathers. I know better. Do you mind that time when Conky was robbed of his money, though? What a start that was. Better than any novel book I ever see.
What was that? Inquired Rose, anxious to encourage any symptoms of good humour in the unwelcome visitors.
"It was a robbery, miss, that hardly anybody would have been down upon," said Blathers. "This here conky chickweed..."
"Conky means nosy, ma'am," interposed Duff.
"Of course a lady knows that, doesn't she?" demanded Mr. Blathers. "Always interrupting you, our partner. This here conky chickweed, miss, kept a public house over Battlebridge way, and he had a cellar where a good many young lords went to see cockfighting and badger drawing and that, and a wery intellectual manner the sports was conducted in, for I've seen them often. He wasn't one of the family at that time, and one night he was robbed of 327 guineas in a canvas bag that was stole out of his bedroom in the dead of night by a tall man with a black patch over his eye who had concealed himself under the bed, and after committing the robbery, jumped slap out of the window, which was only a story high. He was very quick about it, but Conky was quick too, for he was woke by the noise, and darting out of bed, he fired a blunderbuss after him and roused the neighbourhood. They set up a hue and cry directly, and when they came to look about them, found that Conky had hit the robber, for there was traces of blood all the way to some palings a good distance off, and there they lost him. However, he had made off with the blunt, and consequently the name of Mr. Chickweed, licensed whittler, appeared in the Gazette among the other bankrupts, and all manner of benefits and subscriptions and I don't know what all was got up for the poor man, who was in a very low state of mind about his loss, and went up and down the streets for 3 or 4 days, a-pulling his hair off in such a desperate manner that many people was afraid he might be going to make away with himself. One day he come up to the office, all in a hurry, and had a private interview with the magistrate, who, after a great deal of talk, rings the bell and orders Jem Spires in. Jem was a active officer, and tells him to go and assist Mr. Chickweed in apprehending the man as robbed his house. "I see him, Spires," said Chickweed, "pass my house yesterday morning." "Why didn't you up and collar him?" says Spires. "Oh, I was so struck all of a heap that you might have fractured my skull with a toothpick," says the poor man. "But we're sure to have him, for between 10 and 11 at night he passed again." Well, Spires no sooner heard this than he put some clean linen and a comb in his pocket, in case he should have to stop a day or two, and away he goes and sets himself down at one of the public house windows behind the little red curtain with his hat on, all ready to bolt out at a moment's notice. He was smoking his pipe here, late at night, when all of a sudden Chickweed roars out, "Here he is! Stop thief! Murder!" Jem Spires dashes out, and there he sees Chickweed a-tearing down the street full cry. Away goes Spires, on goes Chickweed, round turns the people, everybody roars out, "Thieves!" And Chickweed himself keeps on shouting all the time like mad. Spires loses sight of him a minute as he turns a corner, shoots round, sees a little crowd, dives in. "Which is the man?" "Damn me," says Chickweed, "I've lost him again." It was a remarkable occurrence, but he weren't to be seen nowhere, so they went back to the public house. Next morning, Spires took his old place and looked out from behind the curtain for a tall man with a black patch over his eye till his own two eyes ached again. At last, he couldn't help shutting them to ease them a minute. And the very moment he did so, he hears Chickweed a-roaring out, "Here he is!" Off he starts once more, with Chickweed halfway down the street ahead of him. And after twice as long a run as the yesterday's one, the man is lost again. This was done once or twice more, till one half the neighbours gave out that Mr. Chickweed had been robbed by the devil, who was playing tricks with him afterwards, and the other half that poor Mr. Chickweed had gone mad with grief. "What did Jem Spires say?" inquired the doctor, who had returned to the room shortly after the commencement of the story. "Jem Spires," resumed the officer, "for a long time said nothing at all, and listened to everything without seeming to, which showed he understood his business. But one morning he walked into the bar, and taking out his snuff-box, says, 'Chickweed, I've found out who done this here robbery.' "'Have you?' said Chickweed. "Oh, my dear Spires, only let me have vengeance, and I shall die contented. Oh, my dear Spires, where is the villain?" "Come," said Spires, offering him a pinch of snuff. "None of that gammon. You did it yourself." So he had,
and a good bit of money he had made by it too. And nobody would never have found it out if he hadn't been so precious anxious to keep up appearances,"
said Mr. Blathers, putting down his wineglass and clinking the handcuffs together.
"Very curious indeed," observed the doctor.
"Now, if you please, you can walk upstairs."
"If you please, sir,"
returned Mr. Blathers. Closely following Mr. Losburn, the two officers ascended to Oliver's bedroom, Mr. Giles preceding the party with a lighted candle. Oliver had been dozing, but looked worse and was much more feverish than he had appeared yet. Being assisted by the doctor, he managed to sit up in bed for a minute or so, and looked at the strangers without at all understanding what was going forward, in fact, without seeming to recollect where he was or what had been passing. "This," said Mr. Losburn, speaking softly, but with great vehemence notwithstanding, "this is the lad who, being accidentally wounded by a spring gun in some boyish trespass on Mr. What-do-you-call-him's grounds at the back here, comes to the house for assistance this morning and is immediately laid hold of and maltreated by that ingenious gentleman with the candle in his hand, who has placed his life in considerable danger, as I can professionally certify." Messrs. Blathers and Duff looked at Mr. Giles, as he was thus recommended to their notice. The bewildered butler gazed from them towards Oliver, and from Oliver towards Mr. Losburn, with a most ludicrous mixture of fear and perplexity. "You don't mean to deny that, I suppose?" said the doctor, laying Oliver gently down again.
"It was all done for the best, sir," answered Giles. "I am sure I thought it was the boy, or I wouldn't have meddled with him. I am not of an inhuman disposition, sir."
"Thought it was what boy?" inquired the senior officer.
"The housebreaker's boy, sir," replied Giles. They certainly had a boy."
"Well, do you think so now?" inquired Blathers.
"Think what now?" replied Giles, looking vacantly at his questioner.
"Think it's the same boy, stupid head," rejoined Blathers impatiently.
"I don't know, I really don't know," said Giles with a rueful countenance. "I couldn't swear to him."
"What do you think?" asked Mr. Blathers.
"I don't know what to think," replied poor Giles. "I don't think it is the boy. Indeed, I'm almost certain that it isn't. You know, it can't be."
"Has this man been a-drinking, sir?"
inquired Blathers, turning to the doctor.
"What a precious muddle-headed chap you are," said Duff, addressing Mr. Giles with supreme contempt.
Mr. Losburn had been feeling the patient's pulse during this short dialogue, but he now rose from the chair by the bedside and remarked that if the officers had any doubts upon the subject, they would perhaps like to step into the next room and have Brittles before them. Acting upon this suggestion, they adjourned to a neighbouring apartment where Mr. Brittles, being called in, involved himself and his respected superior in such a wonderful maze of fresh contradictions and impossibilities as tended to throw no particular light on anything but the fact of his own strong mystification, except, indeed, his declarations that he shouldn't know the real boy if he were put before him that instant, that he had only taken Oliver to be he because Mr. Giles had said he was, and that Mr. Giles had 5 minutes previously admitted in the kitchen that he began to be very much afraid he had been a little too hasty. Among other ingenious surmises, the question was then raised whether Mr. Giles had really hit anybody. And upon examination of the fellow pistol to that which he had fired, it turned out to have no more destructive loading than gunpowder and brown paper, a discovery which made a considerable impression on everybody but the doctor, who had drawn the ball about 10 minutes before. Upon no one, however, did it make a greater impression than on Mr. Giles himself, who, after labouring for some hours under the fear of having mortally wounded a fellow creature, eagerly caught at this new idea and favoured it to the utmost. Finally, the officers, without troubling themselves very much about Oliver, left the Chertsey constable in the house and took up their rest for that night in the town, promising to return next morning. With the next morning there came a rumour that two men and a boy were in the cage at Kingston, who had been apprehended overnight under suspicious circumstances. And to Kingston, Messrs. Blathers and Duff journeyed accordingly. The suspicious circumstances, however, resolving themselves on investigation into the one fact that they had been discovered sleeping under a haystack, which, although a great crime, is only punishable by imprisonment, and is, in the merciful eye of the English law, and its comprehensive love of all the king's subjects, held to be no satisfactory proof, in the absence of all other evidence, that the sleeper or sleepers have committed burglary accompanied with violence, and have therefore rendered themselves liable to the punishment of death, Messrs. Blathers and Duff came back again, as wise as they went. In short, after some more examination and a great deal more conversation, a neighbouring magistrate was readily induced to take the joint bail of Mrs. Maylie and Mr. Losburn for Oliver's appearance if he should ever